Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to Revolution Radio. This is Dr. Kate. And hi, Lynn Harden. I see that hand up there. I'm going to bring you on in just 1 second after I give just an introduction this evening. John F. Kennedy said that those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. And I like to remember that statement because we are doing as much as we can to bring about a peaceful revolution, which really our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence would mandate that the government immediately resign. In any case, this evening I just have a brief update on Captain Neil Turner's effort to discuss the Stop the Treason campaign. He gave his testimony in Carlsbad, California. I saw the video. Sorry, I can't put it up right now. I don't know exactly how to do that. But it was very well presented. It's an effective campaign. There's probably some stuff within your city or county rules discussing how you can present this information on the usurper. very important to do. So let me unmute Lynn. Thank you so much, Lynn, for holding that hand up there. How are you? Good evening. You're on live.
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, glad to hear you this evening, folks. The title of our presentation this evening is really If Money Talks, Women Should Be Shouting. And I know Lynn through a number of interesting events and activities and people, wouldn't you say, Lynn? And we've been talking about this for actually a number of years. And I asked her really, what's the revolution she is talking about since our show is about revolution? So Lynn ventured forth to lay out a bold plan to basically address the emerging realities of the marketplace and women's power over the marketplace. Would you say that that's a fair description? And if it's not, please feel free to say that it's not. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you very much. No, I think it's a very fair description, and certainly something that I have been involved in business for many, many years, and certainly it was there when the early women were trying to talk about the glass ceiling and the things that were they felt were holding them back. And the times have changed so dramatically since then, and although it's been slow, I was in our conversation, Kate, you and I spoke, and I said, the Atlantic Monthly magazine, the July-August issue this year, 2010, so it's just come out, gives some remarkable statistics. And one of those is that for the first time in history, in the history of the U.S. workforce, women outnumber men for the first time ever. That is really significant. It doesn't, maybe just doesn't seem so much, but the other piece of that is that the job force, the three quarters of the jobs that have been lost during this recession, were all lost by men. And of all of the categories of, you know, new businesses and emerging business, and 13 out of those 15 job categories that are the projected to grow the fastest over the next 10 years, they are primarily run and staffed by women. We now hold more than 50% of the managerial and professional jobs. And that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And we are now earn 60% of the master's degrees, 60% of all bachelor's degrees, half of all law and medical degrees, and about 42% of the MBAs in college. These statistics really change the entire kind of focus of what will happen over the next, you know, it's a profound impact on the business and investment sphere of in for many years to come.
Let me interrupt you there for a second. And do you mind if I just ask for clarification on certain things?
Not at all.
Because in conjunction with that statistic, I also read another statistic, which is for the first time ever in the history of the United States that government paid out more in wages than private business did. So is there any connection between what you're seeing and what you just talked about and, you know, any kind of maybe a false signal, if you will, of the emerging power of women just because government payments became more, or are we talking about apples and oranges?
Well, I don't think, you know, with the massive amounts of government intervention in all of our lives, I don't think you can ever dismiss that piece of any business. So I have not done any real in-depth study of are these are these women going into entrepreneurial jobs, or are they going into, let's say, government kind of positions? It is my belief that that the 13 of the 15 job categories projected to grow are in the private sector. And I don't believe that that has anything to do with government sector. Women are starting about 70% of the new businesses, and those are entrepreneurial businesses. And a lot of that is because women have completely and always sort of felt that there was a glass ceiling, and their best use of time and money was to do something on their own. So women have been a great driver of the money, and I think that at the end of the day, what my, certainly my focus has been, and what I'm very interested in, is that women really understand that if we want to be in the game, and that is of changing this country, of really having a place here, we've got to get involved in the money. And I'm not talking about government subsidy money. I mean money.
Yeah. So pardon me for that little diversion, but thank you for answering that. So how do we do this? And with this kind of change, what other kind of changes have you seen or that come to mind that strike you as really representing this shift, which is really a revolution in the possibilities for the future of, the economic development of our country?
Well, and I think that I have been an entrepreneur my entire life. And so that I believe in that system. I believe that it is what has made this country great is our innovation and people wanting to be in control of their own business and to be in control of their own life and not I'm going to equate this to my book, The Magic of Why. The point is that as children, all children are always asking why, and very often it gets down to because, and then it gets down to just because, and then it gets down to because I said so. And when we sort of diminish the curiosity in children, and many of us, I was very fortunate because my family was very entrepreneurial, but when we diminish those questions, we sort of train young people that their questions aren't valuable and that they need to get in line and march and, by the way, pay the bill. So it is not surprising to me that we're in the kind of system that we're in right now that, oh, here's a better way, and just, you don't really have to, you don't have to be an entrepreneur, just get a good job and get a paycheck where you can continue to get that paycheck. And we have just got to take back that, our forefathers, for heaven's sakes, crossed the Rocky Mountains in a stagecoach. I mean, can you imagine this?
We're now
too soft to stand up and take back our freedom.
This is very interesting because it seems like, again, from the entrepreneurial, which is really free market, which is really opportunity, equal opportunity versus equal outcome. Equal outcome being the welfare state, it is not surprising that we should be in a place where we don't know how to really kind of stand up, because in what we've been talking about in our show, I don't know if you've listened to the archives, but really, and on Dr. Kate's view, just the sort of programming that's been done, and especially with women. And now what you're saying is because of women starting 70% of the new businesses and other aspects, that if we can just recapture that and spread that, that this will indeed create the shift, a positive shift, back to a place where we have not only responsibility, personal responsibility, but equal opportunity.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I believe it's incumbent upon women to just stand shoulder to shoulder. I heard a woman, and I am sorry if I got her name wrong, but I believe her name is Lynn Tilford, and she has been taking over companies and turning them around, keeping the jobs, keeping the people employed, and this is free enterprise. I'm talking about free enterprise. And she's done this many, many times over. She's a young woman, and she's in the billionaire arena. And her comment was that she said, I have a management team that goes in, and we just stand shoulder to shoulder until we get the job done. And I think in at my very core, I have always felt that that's exactly what women have got to do. We have got to stand shoulder to shoulder, not allow party lines. I've been everything, I can tell you. I've been a Republican. I grew up in with grandparents from the South that were absolutely Abraham Lincoln Republicans. I then moved to a community where if you were a Republican in Florida, there was no reason for you to vote in the early development. And I'm talking about in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s in Florida. Of course, that has changed dramatically now, but you had to be a registered Democrat just about, or you didn't have a voice. And I've also been an independent, so I am still fighting, and still very concerned that this country would divide itself or allow itself to be divided along party lines, as though the party were the important piece and not the people. To me, the people are the government. It is our money, it is our decision, it's not the Democrats or the Republicans' decision, it's the people's decision.
Amen. Amen. And I know you wouldn't run for office, not quite yet, until we take this thing over, right?
Well, it's just really so incumbent upon us. I mean, we come from a space, and as you know, Kate, I've done a lot of work all over the world with women and been involved in organizations that helped women all over the world. And we really do have to, it doesn't matter what race, what culture, what religion, at the end of the day, women want their homes to be safe. They want their children to be safe. They want their children to have a place where they can grow up and have a reasonable opportunity at happiness. And I'm just always heartfelt that we are in a place where we are in our very own country, we have gotten so divided and so pulled apart when we really need to be we should be at the height of the time when we're working in cooperation when we're really looking at a global view and the opportunities, in my opinion, that this country has missed in past administration, this administration, by being egocentric and, quite frankly, greed-driven, it really breaks my heart.
Yeah, we would say here as well, this was anti-constitutional, anti-American, you know, using all these ridiculous ways to divide us, and it is heartbreaking, and yet there is this opportunity now. Sometimes when things get the worst, you see this crack in the window, and it's open, and you go through it. So how do you see women capturing this power, and what do we need to do to coalesce and stand side by side?
Okay, number one, let me just give you some statistics that I believe come from the Kauffman Foundation. Women sign 85% of the checks signed in the United States are signed by women. 80% of the money that is spent, the decision is made by women. We are at a 52 to 54% majority of the vote. So we should be shouting instead of wringing our hands and being, you know, we need to step in to the power that we have. And it is really about understanding that we should be demanding to be on corporate boards. If we are the drivers of this money, I don't care whether it's, you know, a food company, an oil company, an automobile company. You know, we are still sort of given the pat on the head and you know, yes, girls, why don't you do a bake sale kind of thing? I think one of the most eye-opening situations in my career was when I was recruited back to Oklahoma. And because of some things that had happened, I got involved in creating a bill through the legislature in the Oklahoma legislature. And it was a bill that passed during one session of the legislature, which is unheard of. And during that time when I was trying to get this bill passed, and it was a tax on cigarettes, long before the cigarette situation happened, this would have been back in 1993, I wanted to be on a panel for what we call the Governor's Council for the Status of Women. And this was a big situation that happened every year. And someone was, you know, usually a woman was brought in to speak. And women from all over the state would come in and talk about different issues relative to children, relative to elderly, relative to any, whatever issues, health, education, et cetera. And I asked to be on the panel relative to health, and I was told that, there really wasn't a place for someone new on those panels. And so I finally did enough cajoling and made enough calls that I got myself on the panel. And after when I came into the room, and it was at one of the universities here, and I went into the classroom where our particular situation was, where I wanted to present this bill, and it's called, and it passed, actually. It did not pass with a tax, but we actually were funded, and it was called the Oklahoma Breast Cancer Bill. And it was to fund research for breast cancer for women. And I sat down next to another woman, and she was there to speak about Meals on Wheels and how important that was for the elderly. And I asked her, I said, how many years have you been doing this? And she said, oh, this is 16. And I said, and how much money have you gotten from the legislature, you know, presenting here? And she said, oh, we've never gotten any money. And I said, then why are we doing this? It was sort of like bring all the women out, pat them on the head, and have them, you know, go bake cookies and sell them or something. You know, it wasn't about that we were actually going to get money. I was just stunned that these things go on all over, you know, and that women volunteer. We're on so many volunteer boards, while these corporate boards are paying $200,000, $300,000, $350,000 a meeting, and we don't have a place at the table, and we're the ones that are moving all of the merchandise. It's our decisions that are making this happen.
Well, this is really on a massive scale when you think about this. And you know, I have a question. So, and what do we do? And what do we do? And you know, I know you saw in the show description, because this is how I invited you to the show, because I was talking about our Million Women's Convoy to D.C. and you literally said, well, if a million women can march to D.C., we can create, you know, $10 billion worth of, you know, influence. And so seriously, beyond getting on the boards and all that stuff, because look at how long it's taken. I know things are moving faster. And look at the kind of people who are getting on these boards. And yet, you know what I'm saying? I mean, who wants Janet Napolitano on a board, for example? You know, I could go further, but never mind. You know, it's got to be beyond that. So tell me again, how do we move this? How do we exercise it? Because we can't just stop paying the bills, or can we?
Well, I you and I talked when you said that you were talking about doing a million women to Washington, and I said that I have had this, and I even have a foundation that we have in place. We haven't really done what we need to do with it, but this came to me when there was the Million Men's March, and I thought, you know, every man that went to Washington, they almost invariably, no matter how they went, if they rode with friends, however that happened, every truck that loaded people up and went to that march, that Million Man's March, I suspect everybody spent nearly $1,000. And I thought, what if we could start with 1,000 women that gave $1,000 and not spending any of the principal, endowing that those 1,000 women at $1,000, which is $1 million. And then from that $1 million, from the interest, we could begin to advertise and spread out our wings to get a million women that would contribute $1,000 one time. Now, I know that I waste $1,000 in a year. I try very diligently not to, but I know I do. And if we had a million women that gave $1,000, we could endow $1 billion. Now, $1 billion endowment begins to really, you know, it has some clout. And we could use, I believe that a stable society always needs health, education, public policy, and financial literacy. I think if you're looking at the legs on the stool, those are the legs that need to be encouraged. And so I would love to see us as women stand together and create a $1 billion endowment that went from across the country. And I believe if we stood shoulder to shoulder and showed that we could do this with integrity and honesty and not, usurping each other and that sort of thing, that there are a million women in New York. There are a million women in California. We could go from one, there's no reason we would have to stop. And we have got to understand, women have got to understand, that we have got to get into the game of the power of controlling the money. And having money that we can do with as we choose to make these changes.
Well, I'm thinking about this, but I'm sorry, I still can't get beyond thinking like, the wives of the executives of these, Fortune 500 companies just one day just wake up and throw their husbands out and start running the company. But in lots of ways, women probably are doing that. But, also, if those 1 million who marched got 10 women each, that would be the 10 billion. And then carry the vision further, Lynn. How do you see it? Say we got that. Say we got 1 billion and it was growing. And when you say standing together, what do you see? I know you're a visionary and I know you see things. So what do you see? How is that enacted? How is that used?
Well, then I think you just literally use the interest off of that, and today it wouldn't be much, but it, interest off of $1 billion. I really don't know exactly what it would be at today's interest rate. It wouldn't be much, but it would be in the millions of dollars, and up to it. If we were back, if we get back and healthy and interest rates go up, it can be anywhere from, a few million to $30 million every year that money allows to be used for health, education, public policy, and financial literacy. We need to teach entrepreneurialism. We need to teach young women to own their own business, it's the same kind of things that we're now going to Africa and teaching women to have a small business, just weaving baskets. We have so much talent in this country, and for us to be, going down a path of more and more and more government jobs and more government, the only way the government produces nothing, manufactures nothing, doesn't have any income that it doesn't get from us. So all of these government jobs, somebody is paying for them, and it's the people in the sector that are working.
Now, I've got a very interesting question coming up here, because part of the other thing we've looked at, Lynn, here is I would say the money that's gone out the door that we should actually rightfully demand back. Like, for example, Social Security, since the minute it was started, was never meant. I mean, politicians lied, of course. They spent it all. What if we asked for it all back? There's millions and billions of dollars right there. But also, I guess what you're saying is that if we begin to really teach the principles, entrepreneurship, you know, raise that kind of capital, we can begin to have influence on that kind of policy. But, you know, that would be really something. How about asking for the Social Security money back?
Well, I mean, I think we can ask for anything back, but I think, you know, there's not a chance. And I'll say a snowball's chance that any of that we're going to go back and be able to reconcile any of that. But moving forward, you know.
Well, we might if we, like, for example, are able to seize the assets of the Federal Reserve.
Yes. And that's a whole different.
That's a whole other ballgame. I know, but you know me, so you know I'm going to throw these curveball questions out there. So
I think we need to get rid of this whole structure that we've created, and we've created it. So it's incumbent upon us as Americans to recreate the system that was put in place for us, that we have the opportunity to grow and prosper and educate our children to be competitive on a global scale. And we are not. Our schools aren't, I don't think that they're preparing our children in a way that is significant. And this has always been the reason that America has been so strong, is because of our innovation.
Well, you know, this is very interesting, because you're getting at a core of things that I've been worrying about and writing about and talking about for a long time, which is, you know, the degradation, if you will, of, you know, the American character and the dumbing it down. And, you know, as you said, we're not being taught to compete in the world. And I have a visceral reaction that says, you know, we can't even understand how to live in our own country, let alone, you know, quote, make business all over the world. And the sort of, you know, ghastly, you know, world view of Obama is that we're basically nothing. We're just part of the whole mass of humanity to be controlled. That's what the kids are being taught, is, you know, to have a guilt complex and to have all of that stuff, and to view any kind of entrepreneurial spirit as somehow, you know, capitalist and bad and so forth. And that kind of viewpoint is in our schools. And hence, what I begin to see is, you know, the use of an endowment or fund or something like that could also be used to pull kids out of those public schools where they are getting brainwashed, and really have, you know, really have entrepreneurial academies, liberty academies, really get a good education somewhere else besides where the government is forcing our kids to be. Does that sound also like something that a big endowment could be used for?
Absolutely. And if we had, let's say we had a $1 billion endowment, and we wanted to, and there would be, you know, the women that were involved in it, we'd have, you know, we've got brilliant women. Let's take, for instance, you would be involved in a division of overseeing the health. Because if we don't do something about our water, if we don't understand that this matters, it matters what we're doing in our oceans, and it matters what's happening, the kind of conflict. I don't know if you're familiar with the film called Water that was done by the Russian scientists.
Yes.
And just the molecular structure of water that has been in that turbulence, let's say in a tsunami or in a hurricane, and once it comes up on the land, that water that has been
the chaos
in that molecular structure of that water goes right up on all the plants. It is, you know, and they're actually saying that they believe, they know now that there's communication, meaning that it affects all of the fish in the sea. It affects, and the fish then communicate with the animals on the land. Everybody, all living things, sense the trauma. And they're beginning to believe that the reason that when these, you know, a huge hurricane or a tsunami or the things like happened in New Orleans, for instance, these tremendous disasters that people literally are looking like, you know, deer in the headlights, because that's exactly the sense that is being passed on from one species to another throughout everything where that trauma has happened, and even if it started out in the sea. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So that the traumatized water is now embedded in all the plants. It's going down into the soil. It's now the animals are eating that. You know, we really are, it is very chaotic. And whether we understand it or not, I keep visually thinking about the tsunami when, you know, people watched it, what, come back three times?
Mm-hmm.
Stood on the beach, just transfixed. The animals were running up to higher ground, but people were just, you know, we were just staggered. And watching this trauma come back two and three times. And we need to understand that this all matters. All of this, you know, has an effect on us. The fact that we've been in this conflict, in these wars, for, you know, at least these past two-minute administrations, it is taking a toll on us as Americans. The kind of demeaning things that are, you know, portrayed about us and the country at this time takes a toll on all of us.
Yeah,
and we need to step out of that and say, you know, this is a choice, and we can change this.
Well, you know, a couple of things come to mind as I sit here and look out at the Missouri River and realize how many millions of people rely on this river, and being sort of, you know, up gradient or upstream, whatever anyone does upstream affects everybody downstream. And in part, I'm just free-flowing here, sorry, hydrologist, you know how I am with a river and all that stuff. But honestly, the word that came to mind when you were talking about this was a women's militia. And it's the way I define militia is a constitutional defense force. And what you're talking about is sort of all aspects of defense, everything from where our children are educated, you know, to the kind of stuff that goes on in church, to how our watersheds and water supply and livelihood and products are protected. And when you combine that with, you know, with women with an endowment, that could make those kinds of things possible, because a lot of people can't do, you know, child education at home just because of the finances, that kind of thing. But, yeah, you know, encouraging, and within those, within that group, within that crowd of people, those million women or more. This could certainly spread and create a whole new kind of governance that is focused on those points you mentioned. You know, the literacy, financial literacy, but all other kinds of literacy, you know, our health environment. And I think there was one other you mentioned as well. So
health,
let
education.
Me throw that out. Yeah, health education. Mm-hmm. So
public policy and financial literacy.
So am I getting anywhere close? I mean,
absolutely.
I think you can see this as a constitutional defense force. I certainly do. I know exactly what you're talking about, and it's also the various things we used to do anyway.
Well, and I would just semantically choose something else besides militia, because militia seems to be a warring thing. And I think that the great gift of women is when you know, and I have been with women that were in the Bosnian conflict, and if you talk to women, yes, the men go and fight, but what the women do is they get around the fire and they decide, okay, who's got the matches, who can get the wood, who can go get some food. Our entire nature is not fight or flight. Our entire nature is to get around the campfire, to circle up, and figure out how we're going to get through it. So that is our strength. And when we get divided because of political views or religious, this one is, you know, we are in a historic time in the state of Oklahoma right now, because we have just had two women that from both major parties that will be candidates for the governor of the of the state of Oklahoma. First time in history we'll ever have that we've had a female. And it really is historic. And one is a very traditional, actually rather right, far right candidate, and the other one is a very moderate Democrat. And I don't even want to go into the parties, but the facts are that we have the opportunity to get together here and really produce something that is new in this state. And we are, you know, I would say a much more conservative place than most in the country. So if the voters are willing to make these kind of changes here, I think that we're willing to do this all over the country. And we really do have the opportunity. And absolutely, Kate, the kind of things that you're talking about, changing the educational system. Let me just touch on that for a minute. The education was started in the 1900s. So we could industrialize. It had nothing to do with trying to educate people to do anything. We needed to get the farmers to get the kids into a 50-minute hour and 10 minutes off. So that's the way school was set up. And we made concessions to the farmers and said, well, yes, we'll do daylight savings time, and you can have your children all summer to do the crops and everything that we need to do, and that's how we set up our system. So we set this up to industrialize this nation, not to necessarily educate everybody, but from that we are still doing education the same way we were doing it when we started. We are not in a society today that really has the resources or the workforce that can allow children to be off for 2 and 3 months all summer. We aren't in the same place, and nobody needs to go home and plow, because the farms have been usurped and completely changed. and they're plowing. It doesn't matter if it's night or, you know, that's a whole different thing. So if we were still teaching medicine or treating people the way we taught them in the 1900s, you would be in prison. We know that an infant, a human infant, prenatally to 10 years old or 10 years old, 80% is done. 80%. And yet we're spending billions of dollars in higher education to change 20%. We need to refocus money in education prenatally. If a young mother is addicted to sugar, to very often to cow's milk, you've got a problem. You've got a child that's going to be addicted to sugar. I don't know why this is so, you know, what we're thinking here. We need to be teaching these young mothers that if they want their babies to sleep when they're born all night, they need to sleep all night. They can't get up and start eating candy and sodas and you know, milkshakes at 3 o'clock in the morning and expect a child to sleep that is getting the nutrition from them.
I expect that's going to come as a blow to some people, but.
But if the mother is addicted to alcohol or to drugs or to any other substance, nicotine, sugar, the baby's addicted. Caffeine.
Yeah.
The
what
baby
about
is addicted.
Beans and what about
I
beans
mean,
and
this
tortillas?
Is not rocket science, folks. This is
I
this
know.
Is, yeah, so we need to be focusing our dollars and our attention
children.
At how fabulous this can be, and a child can learn
children.
One language or five languages just mm-hmm. as easily if we do it in the early years.
Mhm.
So yes, do we need to shift the system? In my opinion, absolutely. And could we do that with just standing together? Because at a core level, we all know this.
So tell me about the foundation and where you are with it and what a person like I can do. We've talked about this, and I know that I did commit to basically $1,000 and try to find 10 women who would also give $1,000. Is the foundation up and running for that kind of thing right now?
Yes, and what I think anyone that's interested, I sort of have this image, Kate, of the continental United States, and if you took, you know, divided it in half vertically and then took divided it in half horizontally and then just based on population, you know, on both coasts you would have, you know, lines and then, but basically had 10 sections in the continental
mm-hmm.
United States.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have sort of a team captain in each section. And they would agree, those 10 would agree to get 10, who would agree to get 10. So now you're talking about 1,000. And then once we had the 1,000, we would have $1 million. And there is a 501c3 in place. But those 10 that chose to be captains, I think would be the core of the board, the initial board. And then as people had an interest, you know, if they wanted to be on an education committee, if they wanted to be on a health committee, if they wanted to be on a public policy committee, I think this is a totally, it would be one of those, you know, situations where we could have a very cooperative structure and include people and include the gifts that the women that you and I know that are out there have. I have got some fabulous friends in the education world that are just doing some stunning things in spite of the system.
Well, it seems like, you know, there's a lot of things you could focus on, but a few core things to really make a difference. One would be getting the homeschooling going. That would be a very big deal. Can you imagine if women all over this country took their kids out of public school and homeschooled them?
Yeah.
the proper curriculum you're talking about in terms of, you know, personal responsibility and fiscal literacy, financial literacy, and I would add constitutional literacy about what our country is about, in contradiction to what the rest of the world wants us to be. You know, there are some basic principles here that we've got to make sure that it's carried on in future generations. Otherwise, we're toast. We might already be toast. But it seems to me that, you know, if just as a tool, you know, there are plenty of things that could be done. But maybe the focus on a couple of things. I think healthcare would be the other thing. And again, it's with the kids, it seems like to me, with mothers and babies, as we've talked about over the years, Lynn, just about that time period, you know, when mothers are raising their children and what they do and how, and, you know, from in the womb to just the first few months, how much influence there is. So, what do you think? Or, I mean, is the foundation in a place like that where you can possibly throw out some ideas
It's in the very most formative stages.
Mm-hmm.
And so absolutely, yes. And it's exactly what needs to happen. It needs to, you need to have, you know, people that are vested, that want to make the change.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can, and I believe it's a choice.
Mm-hmm. It is. Vision and values, really. Again, I'm just thinking about this, because, you know, these days, what we see, the kind of work that would entail, if, think about what would happen. The government would freak out if women pulled their children out of school. You know, and, you know, that's somewhat of a militia. Women have got to be ready for that. And the guys got to be ready to make sure the government doesn't ride in on horses and take the kids. And, you know, I mean, I've worked in Indian country. Those are the stories that happen, you know, that ride in on horses and take the kids. I mean, it's not unheard of here. But that's why I come to, you know, and it's not going to stick. I mean, just it's somewhat of a constitutional defense force. And our weapons are strengths. And literally, if someone, you know, some federale comes riding onto my property, I'm getting out my gun and, you know, have my own militia. But anyway, so just the power of what you're talking about is amazing, and we have to have the financial foundation to be able to do that.
That's exactly right. I mean, mm-hmm. Otherwise, I do think that unless we get prepared and understand that we need to be financially sound and show that you know, it can be done, because I think that it's an extraordinary time. I think that the possibilities are just, they're exciting if we're willing to stand together shoulder to shoulder.
Wow. So what's your timetable? So as opposed to everyone marching to Washington.
Well,
but
you see
what we're dealing with now is this really, of course, excruciating unique time as our country has basically been overthrown by a usurper. And, you know, and the economy is going downhill, and we see the severe manipulation and literally the destruction of the middle class, and it's almost too much to keep up with. This is, you know, what we're trying to kind of address here. And so I can understand some people who would say, yeah, I can't stop right now and give $1,000 and, you know, look for 10 people to give $1,000. How do we, because, you know, I know the listeners here and so forth, we're all just completely aghast at what's happening to our country. And in terms of choosing priorities of things to work on, not that this couldn't happen along with everything else, but how do we leverage this tremendous idea in terms of connecting it with the, you know, really collective angst right now about the state of our country?
Well, let me just say that if we had, let's say if we had 1 million women and we decided that we were going to stand shoulder to shoulder, and we wanted to, and I can just tell you from my experience at, you know, working with this bill in through the Oklahoma Congressional delegation and through the legislature and getting that passed and what it took to do that. And it was because when they tried to put the bill, you know, when they tried to put it in committee, we had someone in the House, and we met in my house, you know, but we had a woman from that area, regardless of the party, that could actually call the representative or the head of that committee and call her friend who were his constituents. And I can tell you that they did not want a lot of women calling them at home to tell them that they wanted this out of committee. I mean, I don't think we as women understand what a tremendous voice we have if we would use it collectively. And when we used it collectively, and that goes for politics, it goes for education, it goes for, you know, products. But all of this is when you start talking about what would happen if we pulled our kids out of public school, what you're talking about is about dollars. So we need to understand how huge the female population is in its use of and direction of the money that is spent from a household. Household to household to household, whether it's new cars, and if we, you know, wanted to change things as a group, I you know, it's a loud voice. And 1 million could be 5 million very quickly. But we would have to decide that, you know, we would have to literally decide that this could not be about, you know, my party or your party, or, you know, this is about our country and what this country is about. And it's always been about, you know, giving people a chance to be better. When I grew up, Kate, I grew up in a time when on every tablet, on every pencil I got in school, it said, remember the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that was the core essence of what this country was about. And as we went into the late 60s, early 70s, I can remember, really the entire, a very palpable shift, and it was winning through intimidation. And corporations started taking on the essence of, if you do this and wear these clothes, then you'll make people feel less than you, and they'll want to be like you. And it was a very intentional approach to sales and marketing. And as we got into the 70s and 80s, we took another step, and this sort of the underlying mantra became greed is good. Well, you cannot operate a country the same in the same dynamic when greed is good is the motto rather than the golden rule. And I believe what we're really talking about is getting back to the golden rule. Getting back to a time when this is, we're talking about being fair and compassionate and honest and when my dad, when I'd say, they were so bad, what can I do? And he would always say, now, Lynn, just remember the golden rule.
Okay, now, I agree with that, because there are a lot of golden rules I'd like to see coming back, and that one is one of the fundamental ones. But I just had somewhat of a brainstorm as you were talking here, because I agree with you that the issue about pulling kids out of school is about money, because that's where our tax dollars go. And also, that is the reason why the federal government keeps borrowing money from the Federal Reserve, is for, supposedly all this education stuff, which is really large-scale dumbing down of the American population and all other kinds of things. And I had just mentioned the Federal Reserve about taking it over and so mm-hmm. forth. So now I'm thinking, what if women targeted with that kind of, with what we're talking about, what if we targeted all of those items that the government needs money from the Federal Reserve or our taxes to supposedly run? What if we targeted all those things that we don't need that? We would not need that. There's the money. They don't need that. They don't need to borrow. This to me would be both, for our children, but also for our country, but also picking up on exactly what you've been talking about tonight, the power that we actually have to do this, and also this possible endowment to give us the support to get there. Yes. Because if you eliminate the, Department of Education, which I'd actually like to do, for all kinds of reasons, maybe certain programs can stay alive, but others really need to go, then we don't need to pay that. We don't need to pay those taxes. Taxes is another discussion, of course. and then we have more money in our pockets, and then we can do more. This is the same kind of thing that we are going to have to do, is we're going to have to starve the beast in ways that are just completely targeted. So what do you think?
Well, I think that we have the opportunity to create new income, and absolutely we can demand to shut down the beast.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the difficulty is when the largest part of the population is being fed from that hand,
mm-hmm.
It's very hard to vote against, because they're voting for their food.
That's right. That's where they wanted to get this country, is right to that point, and that's where we are right now.
Yeah,
is that heavy line where people are saying, Constitution or my next paycheck. What should I do?
Well, and I think that's the reason that all of these things that we're talking about are about bringing financial literacy so that people can literally begin to create their own income and in new ways. And all of these old systems that we've been doing, what we're about to embark on a global scale is extraordinary. It's extraordinary what we need to be prepared for. And you know, we're not only sending jobs out of this country because they can get, you know, a cheaper hourly wage, but they're having to go around the globe so they can get the kind of scientists and disciplined thinkers that they need for these next steps. And we need to use and utilize the assets of this country, which are the children. And they need to be healthy and educated and bright and thinking about, you know, all of the amazing things that can be done. Which is what this country has been great for. And it has never been complacency. And that's the sense that is frustrating for me, I guess, at this point. Because it seems that we're all frustrated, but we're still, it's not bad enough that we're really doing anything.
Well, it's getting there, but, you know, we don't know what to do, you know. And I something like this is really, it's stunning. I mean, in the Third Continental Congress, we talked about a civic action that would periodically, you know, once, twice a month, whatever, pull the kids out of school on pretty much a local basis. But again, if we can make these connections, and really, I mean, who wouldn't want to pull their kid out of school? Well, fair few who wouldn't. this is extremely serious, because if they can capture this generation. Now, I know for a fact that Obama's educational funding is focused on the fourth graders, and that is a very vulnerable age. And you know who they have is that disgusting Kevin Jennings, right? School safety. You know him, right?
I really can't say that I've got any in-depth knowledge.
He's the pervert. He's basically the sodomite who is the head of the children's safety in schools. School safeties are ridiculous, you know, and we don't want to go there. Anyway, but it's focused on fourth grade, and that seems to me the folks, and even earlier, who need to be pulled out of school, because this is not tinfoil hat stuff. This is very true that we have been under attack for decades. And the easiest way to get in is through the schools. And with the creation of the Department of Education, it's even worse now. And as we have a usurper who is completely, you know, clear about what his agenda is, this again strikes me as a remarkable time to coalesce perhaps around one or two things like that and really have this endowment take off.
Well, and that's certainly possible, because, you know, again, we know now how the brain operates. And again, prenatally to 10 is 80%, 70%, 80% is done. So if we know that, why are we waiting and you know, basically telling a child no, 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 no until they're 6? And then putting him in front of a talking head. I mean, mm-hmm. if you wanted to destruct, you know, the curiosity and the gifts of the brain, we're doing it perfectly.
Well, that's what we think is going on here. And the children are under attack. And like all of us growing up in our lives, basically under attack, but not really being aware of it till we woke up ourselves. Lynn, one of the things that really struck me, and I just wanted your view on this, it was a story I was reading about, you know, the money people and, you know, the influence and the wars and the Federal Reserve and various other unconstitutional behavior. And it was a statement that said, you know, something to the effect that the wasted opportunity and tragedy that was the 20th century. And we stand in the next century now, and we look back, and you can see, you know, we weren't all alive through the whole thing, but look at the world wars and the depressions and the famines. Also, literally a handful of about 4,000 people could make off with the dough. And, you know, everything from the Wilson administration through FDR through, you know, through all of these periods, just unbelievable assault. And just wanted your viewpoint on whether you agree, what opportunity you see to reverse that. And, you know, of course, our discussion tonight relates to how do we turn that wasted opportunity and tragedy around.
Well, you know, you happen to be the one that I was having the the conversation with, and when we were talking about the Planck constant and, you know, just changing one thing now really does, if we don't get caught up, I want to build a new dynamic. I want to build a dynamic that this country, this planet, can literally live in a dynamic of not live with fear and competition and lack, that there's not enough for everybody, but a dynamic that the scientific community, that everything that we're seeing would denote that this is an expanding planet, that there is more than enough for everyone. And because we've lived with this competitive, I have to get mine or there's not enough for me or mine, because we've lived with that for basically all of recorded history, we just need to change our opinion about this and understand that what can we do going forward when it's so obvious if you look outside that everything is so abundant. It is total abundance. You cannot stop it from happening. And if we would just give the planet and ourselves a chance to just be in cooperation and allow things to come back into a natural, I think that a lot of this chaos is being created because of the chaos that we're all in mentally and emotionally. And if we would just stop, I don't want to go build a new house and bring the plumbing in from Wilson and Roosevelt. I want to start a new house that says we can do this in a brand new way. We don't have to hate anybody. We can cooperate. We can allow these things. We know now that each one of us makes a huge difference, that none of us are observers here. We are all participating in this, and we need to participate in a way that is growing into what we want. And what we want is, you know, a healthy planet, healthy children, plants, animals, people. And you know, these start with the very basics of water and our own thoughts about all of this. So, you know, each one of us, I believe, are so valuable in just slowing down this tempo of consternation and conflict, and really looking at how we can, And it's the reason that I believe that it will be women that are in the position to do this. We do not have the same history of conflict and that the men do. And that's nothing against men, but their whole nature is the fight or flight. And when they can't fight and protect, it's they're a bit lost. And the women are looking at, like I said, how do we build a fire? How do we, you know, how do we feed the children? How do we keep things going? And that cooperative sense of coming around the campfire is what we need to do. We need to come around the campfire and talk. And we can talk, but if we don't have money to activate the conversation and to implement what we're talking about, then it diminishes the value that we have.
I wanted to just briefly comment on the issue of abundance and how that would be so different in our lives if we viewed ourselves as abundantly capable, others as abundantly capable, the abundance that we see and observe outside our doors, how that would be different. And I am reminded again of, you know, the ongoing Gulf oil disaster, that the oil they may have found there could be that oil that they call abiotic oil, which is constantly produced as a product of the earth, which means oil is not a fossil fuel, which means gas prices, which means, can you imagine if the people also found out that oil was a renewable resource?
A recurring resource.
A renewable resource. You see? And then the whole concept of scarcity, the documents of scarcity, which drive up cost and so forth and so on, and almost a false indicator of the market. Again, it would be, there's a different kind of milieu that can come in, a different kind of, as you say, structure, a different kind of house that can come in, if you will.
Yeah. And I really believe that we have the opportunity to make those changes, and it starts with our own belief system.
It really does.
It starts by believing that if we get 1,000 women, we can get them. Women and that we can stand together. You know, often when I talk about this, people will say, oh, there's no way. Well, yes, there is. Absolutely we can. Absolutely we can stand together and do this. And I believe that once the women in the United States can stand together and do this, then we can stand globally and do this. But I think we need to do it at home first. Did I lose you?
Oops. I've been talking and talking with my mute on. Sorry.
That's okay.
My apologies. Lynn, we have about 6 minutes left. I'm going to turn to our chat room and ask if anybody has any questions for Lynn. They can call in at 347-838-9176 and press 1, or you can type a question in of the chat. We've had an attentive audience tonight, Lynn, people really listening to what you're saying, and this has been really, really excellent food for thought. And let me ask you if there are any last things you would like to say and offer to our listening audience.
Well, I think that I think there is hope. I think there is hope, and it starts with us. And there's no official that's going to save us. There's no government. We are the government, and it is time that we stand together and take the mantle and be as great as we are.
Wonderful. I just put your contact in the chat room, Lynn Harden at magicofwhy, right? .com.
Perfect. Sure. Yeah.
Very good. Well, this has just been great. I haven't talked with you in a long time, and it's nice to be reminded of, for heaven's sakes, Planck's constant, and that we used to talk about that stuff, because there is an intentional component to this, that, you know, money is energy. There's intention right there. There's energy right there. We talked about water and how important it is to understand about the chaos in our own selves right now, from the kind of assault that we're experiencing from the outside. If you go back to basic principles of who we are as a people, we are cooperative.
Absolutely.
And there's an enormous opportunity to regenerate that. We are in a tough position primarily because we don't know about our own power here.
Yes.
And that it might be important to pull that kind of stuff to the forefront. So with that, Lynn, I want to thank you very much. Let me check the chat again and see if there are any questions. There are a lot of thank yous to you, Lynn, for joining us. I would love to have you on again, and I want to thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure, and more will be revealed.
Lovely. Well, I'm going to play Amazing Grace from Endless War, and you're welcome to stay on the line and listen to the song, but good night, everyone. Thank you very much. Please don't forget to join Walls in Our Minds tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, with Terry Dodd and a couple of other guests coming. Red Beckman will be off for about a week or so. Thank you all for listening. Please take care. Good night, all. Good night, Lynn.
Good night.